to go, Ms. Scott? Absolutely not. You're how welcome to borrow my seat.
Thank you. So if I can ask you to go to section 8 of my written legal submissions, you're probably already there. So I start there with some brief legal submissions on some evidence filed by Ms. Megan Justice in relation to the Kingston Village submission. The purpose of my submissions here is just to clarify the facts, essentially, as that is relevant to your recommendations. So I just want to be clear that an ONL at Kingston is not new. An ONL at Kingston was confirmed through stage one. What is new in this stage is an ONL boundary around the notified settlement zone. In paragraph...
Before you go on, can you just explain, clarify... Those two things didn't seem to mesh to me. Is the ONL boundary that's in the stage three maps in the same place as the ONL boundary in stage one?
So essentially there is no boundary in stage one, it is all ONL. In stage three, an ONL boundary has been placed around the notified settlement zone, which essentially carves the settlement zone out of the ONL.
Right, gotcha.
And the submission from Kingston Village has then sought that the carve-out is extended around the ODP Kingston Village special zone. In my submission, there is scope for that relief, even though the ODP Kingston Village special zone hasn't yet been notified into the review. It's essentially seeking an amendment of that carve-out, but in my submission, it's not necessary to make that change. I will go into this in a little bit of detail, but you've heard mention the exemption zone framework, which has come through the court's decisions in topic two. And essentially what that seeks to do is carve out or exclude from consideration in any plan implementation, so any resource consents or notice of requirements, the application of a number of ONL policies in Chapter 3. So all that would be left is 3.2.5.1A, and I'm referring to the versions of the provisions which are attached to Mr. Barr's strategic evidence. And that was what the court decided should apply, essentially as a backup for any consents that might be made in one of these special zones for additional subdivision use and development that's not provided for in that zone.
So can you give me that policy number again?
3.2.5.1A.
1 capital A. There is one question I had for you, Ms. Scott, arising out of this. 8.4, second line, do you really mean that the relief should not be declined?
It should be, thank you, it should be declined. So at paragraph 8.5, I'm just going to take you through this because it becomes relevant for other RVZ rezonings. Essentially, if an activity is sought of a nature that is not anticipated in that ODP, Kingston Special Zone, there's a requirement to protect the ONL values, which I submit is entirely appropriate in light of Section 6B of the RMA. So the exception zone framework essentially, in my submission, is a positive for these zones. The purpose of it is to acknowledge that these that certain what we call exemption zones are legacy zones that already exist in the ONL. They've come into the operative district plan by way of plan change in the past. There are, for example, there's the ski area subzone, which is an exception subzone, which by its nature has to exist in the middle of our respective ONLs around the district. So the purpose of 3.2.5.1a, working alongside 3.1b.6, and it's 3.1b.6, which lists the strategic objectives and strategic policies that do not apply to any subdivision use or development within those zones. All that's relevant in Chapter 3 is 3.2.5.1a, if you're in exemption zone, in an ONL or F. I'll just add that the exemption zone framework only relates to landscapes. So other resource issues that are covered in Chapter 3, they were still relevant. So it's important that we distinguish between landscape matters and other matters that might need to be considered. While we're making corrections to my legal submissions, if I can take you back to paragraph 6.18. So I didn't cover this earlier in the week. I think we were all ready to finish on, I think it was Tuesday, or perhaps Monday. But I've got two paragraphs there about rezonings located within an ONL. The correction that I'd like to make is in 6.18. So by crossing out the words cannot be absorbed without protecting, and just replace those words with will not protect.
Sorry, will not.
Protect. So that will read, it is submitted that there is a point where the type and or density and or location of development proposed within an ONL will not protect the values of that particular ONL.
And what should happen then?
You should decline the rezoning. If you can't protect the ONLs, the values of the ONL, then it's not appropriate development.
In that regard, I was going to ask you a little later, but that's a convenient moment. What do you say in response to the Transpower and Aurora submissions that they shouldn't have to protect the values of the ONLs?
Well, we have included within chapters 3 and 6 strategic policies. They are still subject to a draft consent order, not yet issued, which seek to, I guess, give effect to Transpower's NPS. And we also have, and I appreciate this isn't before you, in the utilities and energy chapter, we essentially have a national grid specific, I can't remember if it's an objective or policy, it's probably a policy, which aligns the, I guess, problem we have or the difficulty or how we give effect to the NPS in ONLs and Fs. I need to get that to you. As far as I can recall, it's not in any evidence to date.
I think I've seen it. I think presumably Ms. McLeod produces it.
Oh, yes, you might. So we got asked by the judge when we first filed a consent order on regionally significant infrastructure, including the national grid. Aurora's part of Aurora's assets are regionally significant infrastructure, the airport and so on. It's quite a broad definition in this plan. To consider, reconsider how to allow for or to enable in some way, but with a scale of protections for the landscape, which also gives effect to the NPS, which we did. We got back together and had another mediation, and it's the updated draft consent order, which I think Ms McLeod has attached to her evidence. So I don't have it in front of me, but there is essentially a carve-out from certain parts of Chapter 3 or 6. I have to concede I haven't looked at it recently.
Funny that. But I'm looking at the provisions of 6.3, 6.2, where there's still a requirement to avoid significant adverse effects so as to maintain the values of an O&L. So the basic, the provisions are still moving, but we can rely on what's in Chapter 3 and Chapter 6?
Yes. So Transpower essentially has a slightly more relaxed, well, not sure relaxed is the right word, but they have a hierarchy that they need to work through, so they have to seek to avoid, and it's all based on, I guess, the functional needs of the national grid infrastructure.
Yes, you'll recall that I struggled with the concept in stage one that Transpower's NPS enabled them to have significant adverse effects on O&L.
I do. Okay. So back to paragraph 8.6. So I've already addressed topic two, but the reason I've done that is that in my submission it is very relevant for those submissions seeking a new rural visitor zone within the rural zone ONL. The court in its decision redrafted certain Chapter 3 provisions and emphasised that landscape values of outstanding natural landscapes are to be protected. So any rezoning to the rural visitor zone, when it's located within an ONL, still needs to achieve this standard. It doesn't matter that you've got a new zone, you still need to be meeting that standard. And the rural visitor zone is designed in a way that uses different levels of landscape sensitivities to direct development to areas within the zone that have a lower landscape sensitivity. And in my submission, this approach to the rural visitor zone is really important when you're considering whether recommendations on the various new rural visitor zones should be granted. Pursued's not the right word there, sorry.
Question for you. When you're talking about lower landscape sensitivity, is that site specific or is that on an absolute scale? I have in mind is it a matter of finding the lowest sensitivity on site or is it satisfying some objective test of low sensitivity relative to Owen owls at large?
I'm sure I'll be corrected by one of the three landscape experts or Miss Grace, but it's across the zone, so not a site, but the approach has been taken across the wider area, which is to be zoned, which is already zoned rural visitor zone, which is of course the approach council take, was focusing in on the four sites that it notified.
Across the zone or across the O&Ls?
The zone. I have one nodding at me.
But even within that, it would still have to be difficult to see or still protect.
There might be zones before you that do not have, for example, the moderate. But part of when you're looking at that particular area, the approach and the chapter is to identify those different levels of sensitivity and focus development into those areas which are lower.
So if someone came to us with a zone where the lowest sensitive area within that particular zone was not insensitive enough to enable the values of the O&L to be protected, it wouldn't be meeting the strategic objectives.
Yes, that's where I was coming from.
So the low sensitivity has to relate to protection of the O&L values.
Yes.
Not just the lowest between in this bit of land that someone brings along.
Oh, sorry, absolutely. I mean, that's whether you are achieving that is needs to be considered in light of the landscape evidence that you have before you. It's not a matter of just sort of seeing the site in question and giving a certain scale. It needs to be assessed against the values of the wider O&L. Mm. Sorry if I misunderstood your question.
And do you think it's necessary to rezone a site? Some of the sites in the O&Ls are very large, and the sliding scale where even if something's non-complying of high landscape sensitivity might not be restrictive enough.
Well, the test isn't necessary anymore, so I'd say no, it's not necessary. The test needs to be about appropriateness in terms of which zone is to be preferred.
But effectively, say you've got a 500 hectare station on one title, that's hypothetical, could you zone 5 hectares in a corner, RVZ?
Yes, you could.
And I suppose, coming back to the Commissioner's question, does that mean that we have to identify a floor of landscape sensitivity below which, or above which probably, more sensitive. You can't have an RVZ on, and within which there might be gradations of sensitivity and therefore consent status according to how the rules have been written.
I might kick that question for touch, if I may, to either Miss Grace, but also the landscape experts.
Fine. They can all be thinking about it overnight.
And each floor, presumably, is not the same floor.
True.
Thank you.
Look, the next few paragraphs of my written submissions I've just spoken about. It's about the exception zone framework. Before I move on, do you have any questions about how that works?
This only applies in O&Ls.
And Fs, but...
But not in RCL. It's not intended. I'll ask you more about that later, but...
I haven't
finished
now.
For now, the exception zone doesn't only applies in the O&Ls and O&Fs.
Yes, it is. I'll come to that. Because the drafting, I'll come to that.
Yeah, thank you, that would be helpful.
Okay, so under the heading scope to apply the protect threshold to new and existing rural visitor zones. So Mr. Farrell, in one of his statements, suggested that there wasn't scope to apply the protect landscape values policy direction in new rural visitor zones. In short, my submission is there is scope because it's currently zoned rural zone ONL, so it currently has protect policies.
Any protections that are currently within the rural zone could be incorporated into any particular RB zone over and above what's in the notified RB zone.
Any new RB zone.
Yes.
If necessary for that zone.
Yes, that's correct. So the scope for any new rural visitor zone is at one end we have the rural zone ONL provisions, so that includes the ONL specific assessment matters, for example, in the rural zone, and at the other end of the relief spectrum of relief that is available is the rural visited zone as notified, plus any site specific amendments they sought to the rural visitor zone in their submission.
So that was the discussion we had the other day, that far end of the scope is not the notified version, it's whatever the submitter might have sought to amend the notified version to.
Yes, that's correct. And in my submission, careful consideration needs to be given to that because at times the evidence that has been filed goes beyond that.
Well,
I can point to
what's clearly a first in the these processes.
I'll come back to that when we talk about Corbridge.
And you also, I think, and you might be coming to that, stressed to us the other day that when looking at any site-specific provisions that go beyond the notified, like more lenient than the notified RVZ, we need to look for the evidence to support that.
Yes, that's correct. Yes. For example, there are some submissions, I'll just refer to Corbridge. They ask for the activity status for residential to be RDA. The activity status in the rural zone is non-compliant. The activity status in the rural visitor zone is non-compliant. The activity status in the rural zone is fully discretionary unless you are within an approved building platform. Their submission seeks RDA, the evidence seeks permitted. So the permitted, there's no scope for permitted.
And there may or may not, I mean, I'm not wanting to cast aspersions here, be evidence to support the change from non-compliant, potentially discretionary, to whatever they want beyond that.
Yes.
But the other way to look at it is the fact there's evidence doesn't mean that there's scope.
No, they're quite separate. Yeah.
And of course, the site-specific changes sought for the new RVZ, they're a little bit different. So, So just carrying on that theme, there was also question, I think it was in Mr. Farrell's evidence for the scope to apply protect the policy direction to the four notified rural visitor zones. Miss Grace, in her evidence, has recommended some changes to the purpose section and to some of the objectives and policies to make she's essentially sought to make it clearer in terms of the purpose and extent of the rural visitor zone. That she's relied on Miss Birch's submission. That submission is quite broad. It's not specific on. Essentially, it says that she wants the purpose and extent of the rural visitor zone tightened up. There's not a lot of analysis in there, But sitting beside that submission in terms of creating scope, and my submission is that the notified rural visitor zone already includes protect policies. And I refer you to policy 46.2.1.6 and 46.2.2.1.
Following up on this, if Ms. Grace is relying on Ms. Brick's submission to tighten the objectives and policies, is there an argument that tightening the rules is consequential on tightening the objectives and policies?
Well, it would have to be tightening, not relaxing, so
indeed.
I don't think that could get you
to... The reason I ask is that there's a discussion in Ms. Grace's evidence about the desirability of having a building coverage control of the size of buildings, and she's concluded that she can only recommend that for new RVZs. The question is whether the question in my mind is whether that might be a consequential relief in relation to Ms. Brick's submission.
I appreciate you throwing me a bone here, but look, I...
Bridge too far?
I think that's a stretch. I can hear Mr. Bayliss. I can feel him staring down my back.
I'm thinking, just how many appeals is going to get the result?
Look, Miss, is it, I don't know if it's Birch, but...
Birch.
Look, her submission, it's about the... she specifically refers to the purpose and extent. And when you read that alongside the notified protect policies and the ones I've just referred to, and you also consider the other submissions that seek changes to make it clear that this can also apply to the land which is currently RCL, I think together when you consider that I think the scope to do this, I think it's a stretch to suggest we could include the new standards on the 4 notified rural visitor zones.
So you are counselling us, don't go there.
Oh, yeah, love you to. No. Look, I think it's a push too far.
Understand.
So look, at 8.14, we've talked about this, but I'm just... urge caution and encourage careful consideration of what is actually being sought in a submission and what a particular expert is supporting in their evidence. So turning to the scope to apply the rural zone RCL policy direction to new rural visitor zones. So as we've just covered, the council notified 4 rural visitor zones and they were all located in the outstanding natural landscapes. We have some submissions seeking a new rural visitor zone over land which is currently rural zone RCL. If that rezoning was successful, the RCL landscape annotation disappears along with the rezoning. So the new zone would have no relationship to the rural zone at all. By nature of the land currently being rural zone RCL, you have jurisdiction to apply the same rural zone RCL, maintain or enhance policy direction to those to any new RVZ in what is essentially a Section 7C landscape.
So it, you can't rely on the, you can't rely on sort of adopting the words RCL or RCL values or that sort of thing in the policies for an RVZ in an RCL that was in an RCL, because there is no such thing as an RCL in an RVZ, or there wouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
But in looking at the appropriate, which protective policies or provisions to put in an RVZ that was previously in an RCL, you have scope to address the sorts of values, visual amenity values, rural character, and those sorts of descriptive wording.
Yes.
That is in the zone from, that's at one end of the scope.
Yes.
Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. And the court in its Topic 2 decision landed on the wording that for a what they referred to as a Section 7C landscape, the policy direction is to maintain landscape character and maintain or enhance visual amenity values. So for any rezoning in these areas of RCL land, in my submission, the panel needs to be satisfied that the alternative framework through the RVZ is still achieving those outcomes.
I'm struggling with that. Are there any strategic objectives now that have come through the court process that just talk about 7C landscapes and what's to be protected, maintained, enhanced in them?
Yes, there's plenty.
And where they don't refer to them as RCL.
So, good question. So the way that the court has drafted a number of these provisions, for example, I can take you to 3.3.1A, it's at the top of page 3-8. So this is in rural areas, provide for commercial recreation and tourism related activities that enable people to access and appreciate the district's landscapes, provided that those activities are located and designed and are of a nature that, subclause B, maintains the landscape character.
So that seems to be...
So it currently applies to these bits of land. So for example, for Corbridge, that is the current policy direction. So what the council, in my submission, when you're considering a rezoning submission, that's the current, bottom line, for lack of a better word. That is the strategic direction that has been set for that land at the moment.
So what happens with Wakatipu Basin Rural Amenity Zone, which is no longer an RFCL?
Excellent question. So this was considered a lot in the Topic 2 Environment Court hearing and was one of the zones that got brought up often as to how and parties thought that it be an exemption zone. Council agreed that it be an exemption zone, but the nature of the drafting and the decision, essentially because it is not RCL, these qualifiers do not currently apply. They applied when it was notified as rural zone, RCL, in stage one, but through the course of the court, they are not triggered. So at the moment, there are various memoranda before the Environment Court, in particular, one filed by myself, which draws this to the court's attention. Where we have got to is that we're not pursuing that through this decision. However, there are a number of appeals on the Wakatipu Basin chapter which seek to align that chapter with chapters 3 and 6. So we've considered in detail whether there's scope to do that. My submission to the court has already been that there is. Certain submitters acknowledged during the council hearing that there was. So that's something which is allocated to Environment Court mediation set down for the next couple of months.
So, for instance, the regime applying to the Northern Fairyland is in limbo.
Yes. Yes, that is correct. But I just want to make a submission on that, and that just because zones that already exist through an earlier stage mightn't be, for example, subject to the Chapter 3 provision I just took you to, that doesn't mean that the rezonings before you shouldn't have to meet the statutory tests that apply to them. So this land is Section 7C land, and it needs to have a zone applied to it that will meet the requirements in Section 7C.
That's where I was getting to. It seems to me that because of the way the court's been going, and that the RCL concept only applies within the rural zone, if for whatever reason you're thinking of changing the zone to another zone, and it may be that you're changing it for a very good reason, for all sorts of other reasons, like, for example, the extension of an urban area, which there will be, in time, lots of extensions to urban areas into rural RCL landscapes, possibly. So once that new zone's been determined, then policy 331A just ceases to apply.
Correct, and that's why it is extremely important that the zone itself does what it needs to do.
Yes, but the question then really is, what's the appropriate zone for that piece of land? Mm-hmm. And you almost need to go right back to saying, is this a 7C landscape? And those, you know, to confirm that it's a 7C landscape, because this RCL is a bit of a moving feast. It can just be whipped off by a zoning change.
Well, I urge caution in just whipping it off.
No, but it does disappear, you know what I mean?
That's the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
But equally, in terms of the example the Commission just put to you, there are some zones where the rezoning is fundamentally inconsistent with rural values, like an urban extension, and there are some zones where there is a good case that, just as for the exception zones and the ONLs, they should meet the same standards of maintaining and enhancing rural values, and rural visitor zone would seem to be a clear candidate if it's applied outside ONLs. And maybe the rationalisation for that is the lower level of protection for Section 7 landscapes compared to Section 6. They're not a bottom line, something that has to be given particular consideration.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I'm just thinking out loud. That's what happens
at
this time of the afternoon.
Sorry.
I do struggle with this thing that vanishes.
Well, but I think just to emphasise is that it's there when you are creating the plan. Chapter 3 is entirely relevant. It's only
the decisions you make as part of creating plan change.
Yeah. So Chapter 3 is there in full force for plan development. The exception zone framework is only a plan implementation concept.
Okay, that's clear. Thank you.
Okay.
Just because it's late in the afternoon, has Miss Grace made the necessary amendments to the visitor zone to take into account this change through the court process? I think in her second rebuttal.
Yes, she has. Yes. So her second rebuttal reflects that drafting. What it does is highlight in yellow, I think, those provisions which would only be relevant if there was an RVZ in what is currently the rural zone RCL.
Okay. So she's not putting to us that there should be those provisions sitting there waiting for another one to come along in the future?
No, she's not. and I've spoken to her. I think we briefly addressed this the other day. They would need to be there if there was a rezoning outside of the ONL to, I guess, address the type of land that those rezonings are located in, given that they're not outstanding natural landscapes. Okay, well, I'll keep going in the hope that I can finish.
Well, we're going to finish.
Good.
One way or another.
Good. So, look, page 25, the Arcadia rezoning. There has, here I address, I guess, the concept of whether a zone renders the interest in certain land incapable of reasonable use. And I've set out some relevant case law. So at paragraph 8, 18, just the definition of reasonable use. It's the use or potential use of the land is important. And the test to be applied is not whether the proposed zoning is unreasonable to the owner, but whether it serves the statutory purpose of promoting sustainable management of natural and physical resources, which is a question of public interest. And in the Stephen and Christchurch City Council decision, the Environment Court held that a provision in a plan that imposes an all or nothing quality on the land owner's options for a property is likely to render it incapable of reasonable use. And in my submission, in relation to the Arcadia zone, there is no all or nothing proposed.
So, Ms. Scott, just to confirm, your position is that we have both the jurisdiction and the duty to consider the potential application of Section 85?
Well, Section 85 allows you, well, you can raise a Section 85 concern in a submission. There are, that's subclause 1 of Section 85. And I think that does need to be considered in the panel's recommendations and report. In my submission, Miss Grace's view is correct, and that non-compliant residential activity status doesn't render the land incapable of reasonable use. And of course, a resource consent can still be sought as a non-compliant activity status. What Section 85 also does is then allow you to make an application to the Environment Court under 85.3b, and if you do that, then there's actually two grounds that you need to take into account. You also have to consider whether the zoning places an unfair and unreasonable burden on any person who has an interest in the land. But if you look carefully at the drafting of Section 85, that second clause only applies when you're going to the Environment Court.
Yes, I did a case on unreasonable use earlier this year, and we thrashed that out at some length. So there is some Environment Court authority both saying that first instance plan decision makers need to consider Section 85 and the point you've just made that the, however anomalous, the tests in first instance are different to the tests in the Environment Court.
Glad I've got that right. Okay. So any more questions on that? Okay, so this is just really briefly to note that Airbnb have lodged some legal submissions. They lodged them at the same time as evidence was due, I think. And Airbnb, their concern is that they want to align the activity status for residential visitor accommodation in the rural visitor zone with the outcome of their current appeal filed in stage two, where they seek permitted activity status. So Airbnb's interest in this hearing is as a further submitter to Wayfair. It's specific to the Walter Peak RVZ. Of course, the hearing of that and consideration of that primary submission has been deferred. But I just wanted to, I guess, put on the record Council's position on this is that the stage one appeal creates scope in terms of activity status on the zones that were subject to that appeal. If they want to pursue the activity status in this stage, and for the rural visitor zone in particular at Walter Peak, then it is this panel that will be making decision on that activity status. So they need to, I think, be involved in this process if they want to be.
Can I draw your attention to the fact that in my minute providing for deferral of the way PS submission, I went through the way PS submission and said that I wasn't satisfied that your submission here, that it's solely Walter Peak specific, is correct, and therefore that the further submission is solely Walter Peak specific. So I suppose the message would be, if you think I'm wrong, you'll have to give me a little bit more than what you've just said.
I don't change my submission at all on when they need to consider the activity status for residential visitor accommodation. But am I understanding you right? You're saying that the Wayfair submission is broader than just Walter Peak.
Correct.
In terms of that particular
in terms of
bit of relief.
They saw.
Okay, that's and that hasn't been deferred.
Correct.
But they haven't filed any.
They haven't filed any evidence
on that
other than. And so the only thing, at least as regards Wayfair, is they have no evidence on this aspect. The further submitter has lodged legal submissions but no evidence. So we might have to consider what weight we give legal submissions in the absence of any planning evidence.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose the message is that if you think, if you want to maintain that submission, you're going to have to return to the fray and analyse that submission with reference to my reasoning in minute 17 and tell me why I'm wrong.
Look, all I would do is cross out my 8.24 and my submission remains exactly the same, is that they need to consider the activity status through this hearing right now rather than any deferred one on Walter Peak.
Right, and that's in fact the direction I made, that I wasn't prepared to defer to the extent that the submission extended beyond Walter Peak. I wasn't prepared to defer that. So they had to front at this hearing if they wanted to talk about rule status for anywhere other than Walter Peak.
Look, I'm happy with that. I don't dispute that at all. Sorry if my 8.24 is misleading. My point is simply that they can't fix the rural visitor zone through their appeal on stage one, or change the activity status. Fix is completely the wrong word.
Yeah, well, it's a bit difficult to think how they think they can.
Yeah, well, they could have filed evidence in support of their preferred activity status, but they haven't, so. Oh, do you mean from a legal perspective?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to point out to them that they've got it wrong in my submission. So I would also cross out 8.26, or I would change it to the activity status for RVA in the RVZ needs to be pursued in this hearing. Okay, so 8.27, this is simply to ask that if the panel accepts any new rural visitor zones, that we do get the necessary data on high and medium landscape sensitivity in a way that we can put it on the council's plan maps. The same applies to any new structure plans that might come through, any recommendations. It's not anything that needs to be dealt with now, but when we go to, I guess, use the panel's recommendations and then council's decisions, we just need to be able to, I guess, get them into the plan.
I have in mind that when submitters seeking RVZ up here, I should So can you please give me a list of the rezoning submissions that have submitters who have, like, not the second, obviously. First of all, a list of the rezoning applications who haven't yet provided data in a form that the that can be utilised in the council system, and exactly what they, the technical specifications of what they need to provide.
Certainly. Just before I move to the Arthur's Point topic, I was asked earlier in the week about scope to do with the Corbridge rezoning submission and whether there was scope for a some other zone. My answer to that question as to some other zone was yes, as long as it sat between the relief created by the rural zone RCL and the notified rural visitor zone with the site-specific changes sought. The next submission was, the next question was, is there scope for a resort zone or some other special zone? The answer is a qualified yes. Because of the nature of the resort zones or special zones which are in the PDP, they are all different and they provide for different things. So any recommendation of an alternative zone framework still needs to sit within the scope available. So when we look at the definition of resort zone, which we discussed the other day, it does talk about, I guess, urban nodes within it. But the question is, and this is something that we've looked at in detail in terms of the new Gibson Valley Zone, is whether the provisions actually are achieving that that particular that definition of resort zone. So with the Gibson example, I wasn't personally involved in it, but there is extensive Section 32AA and affidavit evidence that went to the court so that the court was satisfied that it was meeting that definition of resort zone.
Is the definition of resort zone or...
is beyond challenge.
Or is it definition of resort?
Oh, sorry, it's just resorts, yeah.
There's a purpose of the resort.
Yes, it's
zone.
Just resorts.
So it's the definition of resort that you're talking about as opposed to the purpose of...
Yes, sorry, yes.
Because each of those purposes is specific to the individual ones.
Yeah, sorry, it's been a long day. is the definition of resort that I'm referring to. And I mentioned before, and this is entirely relevant to this submission, the extent of... urban activity that might be allowed or enabled within that particular resort. And if I mentioned that the for a residential activity, the activity status in the rural visitor zone is non-complying, Corbridge sought restricted discretionary, whereas the evidence seeks permitted in certain parts of that rural visitor zone. So that's directly relevant to the extent of residential activity, whether that becomes urban development, I don't know. That's going to be a matter to consider through the evidence. But caution really needs to be taken as to whether you are still within the scope available.
I think we've got that message.
Cool, good. Okay, another little bit of a tricky issue, Arthur's Point. So at Arthur's Point North, ONL boundaries were notified together with the notified urban and rural zones. The purpose and scope of what was notified was not to revisit the location of the ONL at the wider Arthur's Point area, nor visit it generally. And I think the easiest way to understand my submission is turn the page and look at the figure there. So the area that has been notified is in orange. And then the blue is the changes to the ONL that are sought by the submitter. So in my submission, the only scope that they have available is to consider the location of the ONL around what has been notified and not the rest of Arthur's Point?
I recall that there was an issue. I wasn't sitting on that panel. There was an issue with the stage one maps, that there was like a hole in the O&L, and the panel filled it in, and the Environment Court decided it didn't have scope to do that. Where exactly was the hole that the panel filled in?
Sorry, I'm just going to ask.
That was struck down by the Environment Court.
There's an extension to the south where the trees.
I can recall the chair of that panel telling me that the maps basically provided no endpoint to the O&L. It was clearly somewhere out there, but.
So at the bottom of this plan, the bigger blue area, it's right at the bottom. You can see essentially trees. It's that area directly down. So quite a big area around here. So far away from the Arthur's Point North area that's been notified in this stage.
So does that mean that sorting that out is a job for another process?
Yes, a process that's happening through the High Court at the moment.
In other words, you've got to hope to knock over the Environment Court decision.
Look, this has been litigated and seeing an attempt to re-litigate it in this stage is a real concern, given that we've been in front of the Environment Court, we're now in the High Court. In my submission, there's just no scope to go here through this stage.
Understand.
And just finally, to wrap this up, a quick note around a variation to the subdivision chapter that was notified. The reason I've got this here is it's not addressed in any Section 42A report. Please don't ask me any planning questions. But essentially, a submission was made on it by Carbo Limited. The submission is correct. The variation should have never been made, and essentially the variation needs to be declined.
Background question. I read this with interest, so I went back and reread what was in the Stream 4 report. And I understand Carbo's point, because if there was a if the problem that the Stream 4 committee identified was valid, the variation doesn't solve it. What the Stream 4 committee was saying was some of these historic subdivision policies have been overtaken by events, and so the language doesn't make sense. So the question, the particular question about Wayuna was, is there a wastewater system already in place for Glenorchy and Environs? If the answer is no, then clearly Carbo are right. If the answer is yes, well, that might mean need further inquiry. But I don't know the answer to that factual question. Now you can give me some evidence from the bar if you know the answer.
My understanding is Carbo Limited are right.
That there is no, that everybody...
I'm getting a big nod text from Mr. Barr. Yes.
Several big nods.
Understand. Thank you very much, Ms.
Thank
Scott.
You.
At 5:15, we'll need
so,
any
so
any
sorry,
questions?
Just before we wrap up, just in terms of housekeeping for tomorrow, just so we're all clear.
Before you go there,
okay.
I'll just make sure that none of the commissioners have any questions arising out of your submissions. So tell us about tomorrow.
So we are going to put the panel approach to one side and just go through each expert one by one. I may get bribed by my witnesses as who needs to leave first for flights, but
so
I intend to start.
So is this saying that you're open to bribery?
Always.
Are we dealing with rural visitor zone and Arthur's Point en masse, or are we going to do one after the other?
No, Arthur's Point will come afterwards.
Okay.
Yes. So I'm going to start with Mr. Rossiter, because he's got one site. And then I'm going to go to Mr. Bond. And then either Matt Jones or Bridget Gilbert, depends who buys me a nicer dinner. But they are both, they both have flights tomorrow, but they only address two sites each. And then Miss Malsop, and then of course Miss Grace at the end. If that they may want, they may ask me to change that, but
Mr. Powell.
He hasn't considered any. Oh, Corbridge is dealt with separately because Mr. Barr has taken over the Section 42A on that.
But hasn't Mr. Powell's... Mr. Powell's addressed the Maligans and Corbridge and...
he's not on my list.
But he's on my, I mean, I've handwritten them on mine. I think he has to.
We'll add him.
He's addressed quite a few of the sites.
Yeah, you're, of course, you're quite correct.
Evidently.
You're quite correct. We'll add him in probably earlier. Oh, look, he's flexible because he's local.
He's flexible. He does yoga. He's all good.
Okay, you can figure out that. Is the important thing that we need to take cognizance of is that your technical witnesses are going to consider the entire content of their evidence,
mm-hmm.
and then the planners will be one after the other at the end.
Correct.
Cool, good.
And just before we wrap that up, would the panel prefer if our experts also addressed you on the settlement zone and Arthur's Point all in one hit, and then we just have the planners afterwards? Is that going to make things easier?
I see Arthur's Point as being a settled, it's like Cardrona.
I beg your pardon?
I mean, it's not an RVZ, it's sort of in the bundle of...
Would you prefer the technical evidence separate or at the same time?
Perhaps we'll talk about it tonight and give you a view. I'll send you an email.
Okay, thank you.
On that note, we'll adjourn for the evening. Back 9 a.m. tomorrow.